This is our 26th Talk BD live event, our last of 2022, which is really amazing to me. I'm Erin Mihalik. I'm a professor in psychiatry at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, Canada. I'm actually joining you today from my home, which is just outside of Vancouver on the Sunshine Coast, beautiful unceded and traditional territories of the Coast Salish people. It's my honor to be here to join you today for this event. The event itself is brought to you by the Crest BD Network, where we specialize in psychological and social or psychosocial research in bipolar disorder. And all of the research we do at Crest BD is done hand in hand with people with lived experience of the condition. And we know that the topic of today's event, which is creativity and bipolar disorder, is of great interest to community. I had to go back in a bit of a time machine today through my documents, Sherry, Victoria, to look at when we began researching the relationship between creativity and bipolar disorder. It was 2011 that we held our first major event focused on this area. And really, I feel like it was one of the best events we ever held. We started with a film night where we screened documentaries and shorts that had been produced by directors who lived with bipolar disorder. We followed with a day of consultation on UBC campus where we gathered together 22 people who were artists or musicians or creative individuals who were also living with bipolar disorder. And we had focus groups and we explored their lived experience, perceptions of the relationships between creativity and BD. And then we knocked it out of the park that night with an event at a downtown location where we did a music night. We had a local band who was quite well known and the number of musicians who are also members of Crest BD. And we did a playlist that was all songs by musicians. And it was just a really amazing event through which we learned a lot, but we're still learning, and this was over a decade ago. So I am so excited for today's Talk BD gathering to share what has been going on in this space over the last 10 years or so, and to look at lived experience perceptions of that. So with that, let's begin with some introductions to our panelists. Dr. Sherry Johnson, let's start with you. And as we always do in Crest events, Sherry, tell us a bit about who you are as a researcher, but then also tell us one of the things that you've been doing for yourself over the last almost 2.5 years of tumultuous, difficult times to stay well and balanced in your own life.
Thanks so much for inviting me to be here. I'm Sherry Johnson. I'm a professor in the Department of Psychology at University of California, Berkeley. And my work focuses on bipolar disorder, but also on kind of tendencies to respond impulsively during states of powerful emotion. Over these last couple of years, I think what's been incredibly helpful for me is that we have great access to nature here in California. So camping, running, hiking, cycling, anything I can do to kind of get out there and remember the bigger world of nature.
Thank you, Sherry. Welcome. Victoria, I believe this is your 20th Talk BD today.
I know, it's hard to believe, actually. I don't know when I've been. It's been a long time since I've been 20. anyway, so I guess I'll take it as a compliment. So I'm Victoria Maxwell. Those of you who have tuned in before are familiar with me. I've been a member of Crest since its inception. And what I do sort of outside of Crest, besides being a peer researcher, is I perform shows that I've written myself about my own experience with bipolar disorder, anxiety, and psychosis. And I feel really fortunate to be doing that. And I'm joining also from what's known as the Sunshine Coast, also known as Huilque, the unceded ancestral lands of the Coast Salish people and the traditional territories of the Shoshala First Nations. And I was trying to think of something else to share besides what I have in the past. And Just very quickly, I'm volunteering in a writing program with some a woman who's organizing it with people who are incarcerated in some of the prisons in the US. And we're going through a book and we're sort of doing some mentoring for writing. So a lot of these individuals are sort of putting pen to paper and writing their first novel or their memoir. And then we're helping guide them and critique them. And it's great. I'm learning a lot. So, yeah.
Mm, fascinating. You must give us a blog on that, on your experiences of that sometime, Victoria.
I will. Wonderful.
Couple of pieces of housekeeping before we get going. Know and remember that the questions that we take are not taken verbally. If you would like to protect your anonymity, the best thing is to drop them into the question and answer box in Zoom, or you can pose them via YouTube. A little bit differently this time, all of the links that are being provided during today's talk are actually going to be available on the Creativity event page at talkbd.live, and we'll be dropping the link into where you can reach those periodically through this event. As with previous events, we'll spend sort of the next 20-25 minutes talking about the relationship between creativity and bipolar disorder, and then we'll get into your questions, which are already coming through thick and fast. So I think, Sherry, over to you to begin.
Sure. One of the things that I find fascinating is that there does really seem to be a link between bipolar disorder and creativity. I think Kay Jamison is probably the first person who put this on the map in a really big way. If you haven't seen it, her book Touched with Fire is just brilliant. Very carefully researched. She went through life stories from autobiographies and biographies of so many really famous artists and pointed out how many of them were describing experiences of mania. I made myself a cheat sheet. It's not thorough, but William Blake and Sylvia Plath and Ezra Pond and Edgar Allan Poe. I mean, what would happen to high school literature classes without these contributions? And then in music, similarly, I mean, Handel, Ives, Mahler, Rachmaninoff, the lists go on and on and on. And visual artists, I mean, we've all heard about Van Gogh, but the lists there are also just stunning. Kandinsky, for one of my favorites. Victoria, I don't know if you want to add to that. I can also talk about some of the other sources of evidence, but maybe this is a good spot to get Victoria's take on this.
I mean, just in terms of, and Kay Jamison herself has bipolar disorder. And mm-hmm. I think what was disheartening for me in the beginning when people said, oh, well, look who has bipolar disorder, some of those people died by suicide. And so it wasn't something that inspired me. But then there were other individuals who were prolific and produced incredible qualities of work and were living great lives. And even now we see it more, like Demi Lovato, I think Halsey, Russell Brand, sort of some people that I, Mario Banford, the comedian and things. So to me, even the contemporaries are even more important to focus on, because sometimes I also trust that they're discussing their own diagnoses as opposed to us assuming, looking at the individual's behavior and coming to a conclusion that they had bipolar disorder, even though it's very likely that it's true. So and I find them very hopeful because they're doing things that they love and they're thriving. And I think that's, for me, that's the kind of take-home message that I wanted to see.
Terrific. Yeah, so, you know, I think what caught my attention is all these famous people. But a lot of scientists live with a certain degree of cynicism. And so scientists were cynical about this, like they are about many kind of findings. And the big criticism of this work has been, well, maybe part of why they were famous is because they were living larger than life, kind of dramatic lives. They had a lot of, you know, presence. Maybe part of that's because the mania, and it made it more interesting to be a focal point of biographies or autobiographies. And so a lot of scientists were like, what else have you got? And at this point, we do have a lot else. I mean, so one thing people have done is they've gone into groups of artists and musicians who are really highly accomplished, like the Iowa Writers Workshop. It's the sort of dream slum kind of workshop for really terrific writers. And they've gone into that and said, okay, how many people here have experiences of bipolar disorder? And they come up with rates that are like 8%. Instead of the 2 to 5 kind of range that you see in the more general community. And then this guy, Simon Kayaga, takes the entire data set for Sweden, all the mental health records in Sweden, and he says, well, let's trace who got treatment for bipolar disorder and who is working as an artist or in an occupation that's artistic. And he shows that people with bipolar disorder and their family members were much more likely to be employed as artists, as authors, as writers, you know, so in these creative jobs. Not everybody, though. It looks like of people with bipolar disorder, maybe, you know, 5 to 10, maybe 5% of people end up in these creative occupations. And I think that is something Victoria was asking me about last week. Like, is this everybody? And I want to be clear, like, no, it's not everybody. So Victoria, I don't know if you have anything you wanted to chime in about there.
Yeah, I think also that I know because of the audiences I've spoken to, that people who maybe don't feel that they're creative, or they're definitely not in what would be considered a technically traditional artistic career, then all of a sudden feel like, well, now am I like a defective person with bipolar disorder because I'm not creative or something. And so I think it's really important also not just to recognize that not everybody, like it's the 5% of people with bipolar disorder, as opposed to, I guess you were saying, 1 or 2% in the general population. And so that's not necessarily, it's not like expecting 50% of people with bipolar disorder, but it's also, I think, important to recognize that creativity is defined differently. It doesn't need to be penned into pursuing an occupation. I call something, it's like everyday creativity. So people who, whether they may have a hobby, but they may not have a hobby, it may just be that the way that they cook their food, or the way they put their outfits together, or the way that they have conversations and things, that it's slightly a bit different and a little more, artistic in a way, but it's in a very everyday kind of way. And so I think that can allow people to feel a little bit more included and understand it on a much more realistic basis as well.
Yeah, and the evidence bears out what you're saying, Victoria. When people have gone in and given scales that are about how often do you show creativity in your daily life, like in the way you set your table, cook your food, arrange your flowers, whatever you're doing, that tendency is correlated with how much people report some degree of manic symptoms during their lifetime. So that's, I think, a really important part of this. And then the other thing is just, you know, how much creativity people show in whatever occupation they're in. So you can look at, there are scales of, say, how entrepreneurially creative a person is. How much are you the person that solves things in the business world in a creative way? That's also correlated with hypomania. It doesn't have to be, yes, I'm a published author. I think it comes through in lots of other daily life sorts of things. So. Maybe it's helpful if we talk a little bit about, okay, when during the course of bipolar disorder does this come out? Because I think the number one question that a lot of people have is, well, do I have to be manic to have creativity? And are my medications going to interfere with my creativity? And we get this question a lot. First thing I want to say is that depression makes it very, very hard to be creative. Creativity takes a certain amount of energy. It takes a certain amount of self-confidence, and depression is really menacing for both of those. So sometimes when people come out of depression, they're inspired to try and make sense of things in a different way. And that's different than just being in the depths of depression, I think it's pretty clear scientifically and also just personal accounts that that's painful for creativity.
Yeah, I can sort of speak to my own experience to that, is that there were, I guess, two or three points, is that when I was depressed, like you said, I mean, I could barely get out of bed, let alone feed myself, let alone write anything down or want to go to an audition or anything. So my creativity felt like it sort of just halted. But then when I was in a manic state, I'd be writing prolifically, like poetry and, you know, stories and all this stuff. And they were really, really bad stories and bad poetry. And although I thought they were really great, of course. And I guess what the hopeful thing was, is that when I was offered medication, one of my fears, and I think a lot of people share this, is that the medication's going to dull my senses, dull my creativity. And so I, you know, was quite hesitant about that, or the side effects were going to do that. And what I found was that my creativity is far more stable, even though I rarely go into mania. I might have a little bit of hypomania, but not that particular amount. The quality of my work is much better, and the sustainability of being able to do it on a regular basis is much more consistent. And it's not just medication, but it's just having treatment, right? And having my own self-management tools and things like that. And creativity is one of those self-management tools as well. And I don't know if there's any research around how medication affects creativity, but I know for myself is that the quality of my work when I was in any of the episodes, I didn't have a good objectivity as to what the quality was like. And in retrospect, when I look at it, it was not very good.
Victoria's not alone in that experience. There is some lovely analysis of Schumann's musical portfolio, because Schumann was, we have a good record of what dates he wrote music, and we have some records of what his mood swings were, and people have gone back and put those together. And when Schumann was more manic, he wrote a lot more notes. He got a lot of notes on the page. But if you want to look at what part of that catalog is still being played, it's not the manic pieces. It's the pieces from when he was in a more stable state. And so that's one way people have looked at this. The other thing I always tell people is that one of the better studies we have out there, the researchers go in and they interview people about how much they've accomplished in terms of creativity in their lifetime. They ask them about, you know, have you written poetry? Have you published poetry? Have you written stories? Have you published stories? Have you written music? Have you had it performed? Have you performed music? They categorize everything, right? And they do these interviews with people who have bipolar disorder that's severe, people who have bipolar disorder that's mild, and their family members. It turns out that the group that was most creative was the family members. Now, when I hear that, I think, okay, good news. It's in the genes, not in the symptoms. You don't need those symptoms to have the creative output. What you need is the genes, and you were born with those. So great. No reason to push the mania as though that's going to make you more productive creatively.
That's, because when I first heard you say that, I went, oh, so that means people with bipolar, their families get most of the creativity. But I hear what you're saying is actually that when they're comparatively, it's who has the most, is it has nothing, the correlation isn't to do with the actual symptoms of severe mania or mild mania. And that is good news.
Yeah. The other thing that came out from that study is the people who had more severe mania were having less creative accomplished than the people whose mania had only ever gotten to a more minor point. And that makes sense, because mania makes it difficult it interferes sometimes with the opportunities that people might have. Their kind of sense of self-esteem can take a hit, and you need your self-esteem to kind of really successfully put yourself out there as an artist. And so really what that study said to us is we've got to protect people. We have to kind of help them have a kind of stable spot to let this creativity flourish, is how I think about it.
But, yeah, and I think also, and you may know about this, is that when it's a severe condition, that it would depend on a person's access to treatment as well. So people who are more privileged that have severe bipolar disorder, but have maybe earlier access to treatment and more comprehensive, they might have the ability to be stabilized on a better level. And then the creativity, so they don't get, they may not get captured in the same kind of research in some ways.
Exactly. I mean, everything I know says we've just got to protect people and help them kind of find a stable space where they can kind of have their creative strengths come through. And there's no evidence that medication profiles are correlated with less creativity. Although one thing I think is really important to talk with doctors about is if your medications are so sedating that you do feel duller, then it becomes really important to work with your doctor on, okay, how do we adjust this? And, you know, how do we find the kind of right profile so you're not feeling that sort of heavy, blunted thing?
Yeah, and that's what I went through, actually, because my mom has bipolar disorder, and she worked, lithium worked really well. So they put me on lithium right away. And or when I finally accepted that I would take the medication. I just had flat affect and really couldn't experience very much. And creatively, it was, you know, for me, sort of a disaster. And so really it took probably 2 years to find not only the right kind of medication and the combination, but also the right dosage. And so, and it was not just me. I mentioned it before that my dad helped advocate for me because he saw still the symptoms that were breaking through. Like maybe I wasn't going into psychosis or I didn't have the severe anxiety, but I was still having sort of a lot of depression or I don't know if I was having mania necessarily. And so he went in once with me to my psychiatrist and just said what he saw. And I think it helped my psychiatrist figure out, okay, so this is maybe what we need to tweak and move over here and do that and stuff. So I really encourage people to don't give up if you feel like, you know, this is as good as it gets, because that's exactly what my dad said, is that this isn't as good as it gets. And when you're suffering, and I don't use that word very frequently, when you're suffering with an episode within bipolar disorder, it's often not just hard to advocate, but I didn't feel like I was worthy to advocate for. And so it's, I think, really important to have somebody that's got your back and can do that, so that the things that are important to you in your life can stay in your life.
Well put, Victoria. You both very elegantly spoke about the relationship between elevated mood states like hypomania and mania and creativity. But I'd love to hear your perspectives as well briefly on the relationship between episodes of depression or even mild symptoms of depression and creative outlets and outputs.
Yeah. We know even outside of bipolar disorder that unhappiness and worse depression are terrible for creative output. There's a lot of mythology that's, you know, you struggle, that inspires art. But in that state, they are crushing for creativity. Now, that's different than saying, okay, when you come out of the depression, you may want an outlet to put into words and to be able to kind of rethink your experience, and you may be inspired to try and communicate that experience. But the state itself is so rough on creativity.
Yeah. And that's the only thing that I have seen is that within the state of depression, even if it's mild depression, because it's that sort of loss of interest in things, right? Yeah. And then the more severe it gets, the more disabled I can feel or lack of functioning. But it's afterwards where because I feel so much better, I might be inspired just to do something creative. And then because I've had this experience that is so, you know, lends itself so much to being able to be expressed in a creative way, I can use that as fodder, but I still feel like I could write about things even if I hadn't gone to those depths. I totally agree with the whole thing that I've rarely seen anybody who's so depressed. To me, it would be this similar to if someone was struggling with severe alcoholism or substance use. You know, you can only create in the very beginning stages as that's happening, and then as it gets more and more severe, it just deteriorates. You've seen people who just, you know, aren't being able to do that kind of stuff after when they've had years of substance use, misuse, or alcoholism. So
there's a psychologist who's part of the CRESBD network, Greg Murray, who's even argued that because creativity and depression are so tightly entwined, that one thing for a person who really does have a track record of being creative, so let's say that it's been part of your daily life to write or to paint, that might even be an index for you and your doctor to pay attention to and whether you've got the right medication profile. Like, am I getting enough relief that I can go back to painting or that I can go back to my creative endeavors? It's kind of a signal of like, are we lifting that depression enough?
And when you said creativity and depression are intertwined, you're talking about because they sort of are indicators for each other, that if one is around, the other might be going
right
down.
Right. That inversely intertwined, so that if I'm feeling depressed, it's going to be harder to be creative. So a signal that my medications and my treatment are finally lifting that would be being able to get back out there and create. So it's an outcome for you and your doctor to watch.
And the other piece of that is that it really speaks to the importance of asking and working with patients around, you know, what outcomes do you care about? You talked about Greg Murray's work, and I think it was him that presented on a case of a patient he was working with who was a violinist and was experiencing a side effect of tremor, which made it impossible for her to perform and have her career. And that for her was an absolutely untenable side effect in terms of the thing that she cared about the most in life, which was performing and playing her violin. So just the nature of that conversation and shifting around what outcomes do you care about the most, and let's work towards those, is critical too, I think.
Maybe we can talk a little bit about, okay, so you are an artist with bipolar disorder. How do you survive? How do you protect? How do you nurture this? Victoria, I don't know if you want to go first. I have a couple thoughts, but you have a lot of thoughts here.
I think we probably share some of them. The first one for me is always sleep. It's sleep, even if it's not about creativity. And that can be challenging, particularly, let's say, if you're an actor and you're doing overnight shoots or you're doing sort of a run that's, you know, shows that end at 11 and, sleep patterns. So, and for me, it's when, like, I'm beginning to travel, but I was traveling a lot. So there were time zone changes and just sleeping in different places that I wasn't familiar with. So making sure that if my sleep has to be irregular hours, how do I make it as consistent and as familiar as possible so that I get the best quality sleep? So it might not be the same hours every night or at the same time, but how do I get the deepest sleep and maximize it as much as possible? That's probably the first one, because if that shifts, then my mood really begins to go. And I think also really the first thing that comes up is about my self-esteem. And so there's often a lot of rejection involved in the arts. And so finding ways to build my resilience. And that has come a lot with a therapy, counseling, and also a strong social network. So I have friends around me who are my cheerleaders, and I can sort of disregard the one, you know, grimace in the audience where they, or like this, what happened when I was performing, where this one guy was actually reading a newspaper and turning the newspaper really loudly while I was performing. And I said, all right, I know that the newspaper has more interest than me. And so that, you know, and so being able to talk to friends after that and laughing about it and everything. And obviously it meant something to me because I'm still talking about it 10 years later. And so those kinds of things, I think. And I think that there's a couple of other ones I know you were going to mention as well.
You know, I think those are two really critical pieces. And with the sleep, one of the things I think that can be very common for people with bipolar disorder is a kind of once they're excited about a goal, they're going to go full bore after that goal, and it's hard to kind of disconnect. And I always sort of say what you want to do is test whether you still can disconnect. You get excited about a project, tap the brakes and see if you can still slow down. And I think we tell this story in the art and creativity world of like, oh, only, you know, only through sheer 99% perspiration am I gonna like excel as an artist. And yet, go see a Lifetime retrospective of a famous visual artist, and you will see that they spend 20 years coming and going from a theme. But I think it is the coming and going that allows us, each time you come back in with a little bit of a new lens and a little bit of insight, and you can't have that unless you put it away, get your sleep, and then come back in. So I think there's a lot of reasons for the sake of creativity, but also your health, to tap the brakes, get your night's sleep, and then come back in fresh.
There's a quote that sort of applies, and it's been attributed to a number of different people, but it says that it takes 20 years to be an overnight success. And I think that's, you know, very hopeful for people, for those of us that are quite impulsive and impatient, that want to just do it now and, you know, go for it and wonder why it's not happening all at once. So, yeah.
Yeah. And then I think also this, you know, creativity is a world that engenders criticism, and there is criticism of things that are closer to the heart than many of the other things we produce as human beings. These are expressions that are uniquely ours. That's why they're creative. And so I think self-compassion for that process, school yourself in how many really incredibly accomplished artists have faced people saying, no, no good. Like give yourself some room not to respond to every critic who decides they'll pop their head up and tell you what's wrong. So I totally agree. Like have your friend circle around you and your other ways of restoring. So breaks.
I love that of self-compassion. Thank you both for that. We have a lot of questions coming through. Do you feel like we're ready to move over to some of them?
Yeah.
Okay. So there's a cluster of questions, first of all, about the different types of experiences of bipolar disorder and how they relate to creativity. So is creativity, for example, more common in people with bipolar disorder type 1, which is characterized more by mania, or bipolar disorder type 2, more hypomania? Is there a relationship between experiences of psychosis in bipolar disorder and creativity? Can either of you shed light onto those relationships?
Sherry, do you want to sort of share the science part of it?
Sure. I mean, so what we know so far is that if you were to try and find a bipolar related population that has the best levels of creativity, you would look for people who are in the family. Then you would look who haven't had symptoms. Then the next up group would be people who've had minor experiences of mania. And as you see people struggling more with episodes that aren't getting quelled, and the costs of those, you see less likelihood of this kind of beautiful expression of creativity. And when we did our consumer workshop, there was a woman that showed up who said this so poignantly. I wish I could remember her exact words. She said, "Every episode I go through takes away another piece of my self-esteem and makes it just that much harder to be creative. And so if I have a wish, it's that we keep those symptoms more minor and give people more stability. And then I think we will see more creativity." But Victoria, do you have thoughts about that?
I guess I would just caution around that message so that people don't become fatalistic.
I'm glad you said that.
Yeah, like if they've been diagnosed, because I've had bipolar, I mean, I've had severe bipolar one, and I've experienced psychosis. So, and not necessarily that there's an exception to the rule, but that when you, you know, become really proactive in your own recovery, that's when you can be really involved and proactive in your own creativity.
Perfect. Yeah. I totally agree.
Yeah. I mean, I know that's not what you were saying, but I think sometimes that's the message, especially if someone's first diagnosed and they're you're just getting your bearings. It can sort of feel hopeless if you hear something like that and forget that it's very nuanced.
Thank you. I certainly don't mean to imply that. I guess I really do just want to argue that recovery will help with this.
That's the thing. I mean, the good thing I think is realizing that the genes that we've inherited are in us, not the illness. And so the illness itself, as we get better at managing it, the more that those inherent abilities will be able to be expressed. That's what I found. So even with me going through several psychoses, I was able to move through it the more that I got experience under my belt managing it and stuff. So
yeah. And if you look at the very famous people who've had bipolar disorder, many of them went through multiple hospitalizations. They had rocky roads. So yeah, I don't want to be in any way fatalistic. I just think that recovery helps this process.
Yeah.
You've both talked quite a bit about some of the classic interpretations of creative professions we have, musicians, artists. One of the questions we've had come in is, what about entrepreneurs, people who are engaged in startup companies? Is there any evidence that you're aware of, Sherry, that's looked at?
Yeah. We have published findings from several thousand entrepreneurs showing that they do tend to have higher levels of hypomania. And in that paper with Michael Freeman, we also looked at people who were in the Inc. top 100 entrepreneurs and saw higher rates of hypomania experiences there. So there's a really important relationship there, because I think particularly in the business world, it's important to get that word out. The other place where it shows up is university professors. And Simon Kayaga has published on that. I like to think we're creative in our own way. And he has data to support this link with bipolar disorder. And that rings true in my experience. I'm at UC Berkeley. It's a great school. I landed there 12, 13 years ago. And the number of people who made a rapid path to my office to say, "This thing you study, it's in my family." Because it's actually pretty common among university professors that they have this background in their family. So
It's pretty, I think also, I mean, from what I remember hearing is that it's sometimes been nicknamed the CEO disorder in terms of bipolar disorder. So a lot of, people who need a lot of creativity, a lot of energy at times really can leverage this. And I think that's it, is that being able to take the very good things that we learn and that we have through bipolar disorder and being able to siphon that into whatever we're doing as an occupation or whatever we're doing in our life. So if we don't happen to be employed full time, whatever we're doing for our occupation during the day, I think is what's really helpful.
Mm. But you can also see that there would be certain inherent advantages of working in, say, an academic environment, or maybe in a startup or industry, and that you have a lot of latitude around how you spend your time and a lot of control. But there are other professions, you know, working in the service industry, being a musician, where it's quite challenging that you can be exposed to drugs and alcohol on a daily basis, sleep dysfunction and dysrhythm. And so, you know, really thinking about those professions and perhaps some of the inherent risks that come, or advantages that are conferred by certain professional areas, is probably worth thinking about too.
Agreed. Agreed.
So many questions. Let's move on to some of the ones about sort of treatment and intervention and protection. I'm really intrigued in hearing the answer to this question. Do we know whether people with bipolar disorder may actually benefit more from creative focused therapies like art therapies or music or dance based therapies than people who don't live with bipolar disorder?
We don't have a science there. I think we need a science there, but it's almost seems impossible to imagine it wouldn't be helpful for a lot of people. But yeah, no randomized controlled trials. Victoria, do you have any experiences you want to draw on here?
Yeah, I was thinking about it. It's that I haven't ever done any sort of artistic or creative therapy. What I do see, though, is I have led a writing course called Creativity as a Catalyst for Courage. And so I see creativity as being therapeutic. So even if it's not being used for therapy, most of the feedback I get afterwards is that people have found it really healing, really wonderful, very supportive to be able to share their story, to write about what they've been going through, share it with others in a safe group, have, you know, that kind of support, and also have a treatment team behind them so that if anything gets triggered, they can go. So that I've done it 3 times. And so, and I've seen results like that each time, 4 times actually, where it's been sort of made a really big personal difference in terms of both confidence. We did where they measure sort of certain recovery elements and before and after, and so that there was definitely an increase in certain areas and stuff. So
yeah, and I think there's a lot of other practices that can be very therapeutic. One of the women that came to our workshop was a potter, and she said, you know, spinning my wheel is an incredibly calming ritual for me. Authors get to tell their story, and I think that has a lot of power. But the other thing that we heard from was playwrights who said, you know, really, I wanted to be able to make a difference in people's understanding. And Victoria is a classic example of somebody who has used her experience to help the world understand things a little differently. And that's also, I would imagine, it must be so powerful to have this ability to channel those experiences towards something so pro-social.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that I have found is that it's really liberating. And I guess the thing that I experienced is that something that I was really, really confused by for so many years, and I don't even know if the word was ashamed of, but felt very frightened of for so many years. And then I'm able to go back on a stage and tell this story. And it's like a family reunion that everybody's laughing at the inside jokes. You know who's been there and done that, because they're the ones that are laughing. The other people aren't. And being able to share it. And it's been very, very healing for me. Absolutely. And then to be able to come full circle, because I was trained as an actor to begin with. And so to be able to perform it in particular is extremely healing, and to write it as well. So, yeah.
And it's certainly a method that we use in a lot of our research at Crest BD when we work with communities to shape ideas. We don't really hold any events anymore that we don't incorporate something like graphic facilitation or graphic recording, where we either have members of the audience or a professional artist come in to capture the essence of the dialogues visually. And I really think that that is a method to co-design and for our research has been really pivotal for our work over the years as well.
I do know and recall it, but this was for anxiety, is that there's a whole program about improvisation. So you people who learn improv who have anxiety disorders, which you would think would just instill absolute panic in most people. And there's research to support that it actually helps people reduce their anxiety because of a number of things. People learn to be spontaneous. They learn to trust themselves. They learn to trust other people and things. So for bipolar disorder, I think certainly it can be a real mood, I would say mood booster, but I meant more like self-esteem booster and confidence booster.
Well, let's stick with the art theme for a moment. And then this is a poignant question. I'll read it verbatim. So ever since my last manic episode, I'm afraid to make art again. I remember how last time it started with just being really inspired to paint, and then it got worse and worse, and I ended up in the hospital. My art practice is important to me. How can I start painting again without getting manic?
Yeah, this is interesting. How do you do something you love, which I think we want to. We all want to do the things we love, but then be able to test the breaks for, can you walk away? Do you have breaks still? You know, so we do these things that get really exciting and really valuable and really meaningful, but can you set almost a clock that says, okay, after half an hour or after an hour, whatever the time period you think is appropriate, can you pause? Could you disengage? Could you back away and put it away for a little while? And if you can't, what's your rescue plan before you get in there? Who's going to be the person who kind of helps you navigate that?
I very much relate to that. I relate to it in some other ways, not as much as with my creativity right now, but with some other practices, a meditation practice and a new healing modality I'm working with. And so I did exactly what you suggested, Sherry, is I talked to my therapist and she said, so what are the signs that you see when you would be starting to go in the wrong direction? And so I started to say, well, I would be talking about it all the time and I wouldn't be able to sort of disengage very easily. And then we kept talking about the earlier, what's like the earliest signs. And then what would I do if that was the case? So that was sort of a safety net, which also allowed me to relax a little bit because I felt then I could go into that. And then being very clear about the boundaries, about what I'm going to, and it's exactly that thing. Okay, so I'm going to say I'm going to like prescribe 20 minutes and that's it. And if I have trouble with 20 minutes, I need to talk to my psychiatrist or my counselor or my friends, and then find a way. It doesn't mean that I can't do it, just means find another way to engage in it that's safer. So maybe it's with other people at the same time, or, you know, bookends. And so there's always ability to troubleshoot, but it's just really being honest with yourself and then taking those precautions, I find.
I just want to also highlight that I don't think this is an unusual concern. I had heard this kind of story enough times that we did a study on it, and we asked people who had bipolar 1 disorder, have there been times in life when you avoided the most meaningful and valuable roles because you were worried they would make you sick? So falling in love, having kids, doing a job change, doing your art, and 2/3 of people said they had struggled with that at least once in their life, which I find really sad. and says to me just exactly what Victoria is coaching here. We need to kind of find ways to give people skills to enjoy those incredibly powerful moments safely, with comfort, with confidence, with bookends, with support. We can't have people just retreating from the things that are most exciting. No. It's not okay. No. And I think self-management and skills and support are really powerful tools here.
I think we have time for a couple more questions, but we won't be able to do this first one just service the amount of time we have. But it's really how are people with bipolar disorder more creative? What's the neuropsychological basis for that? And maybe, Sherry, you could just reflect on how far off or how close we are to understanding some of the precise mechanisms underpinning this relationship.
Yeah. So for years, I thought we'd find a silver bullet mechanism. And then when we did our kind of focus groups, I realized there's not going to be one mechanism. Some people are doing it for self-expression, for soothing, because they have life experiences to write about. And then for others, there may even be a personality or neurocognitive piece to this. We've worked really hard on the idea that one of the things that comes along with bipolar disorder genes is a willingness to work hard and persevere when there's not like a big giant reward at the other end. People with bipolar disorder across a lot of studies will work harder and be more ambitious, even if it's not clear that there's some huge payoff. And we can see that in personality and behavioral scales. I don't think it's the whole story, but I think it's part of what's in there.
That's I hadn't heard that before, and it actually is quite moving to hear that, because I've always felt that, but I didn't know that that was actually in the science. And I don't know, Sarah, is there anything about, in terms of that ability to sort of I don't know if it's malleability, but the fact that because it's a mood disorder and we're going into these depths and things like that, does that have anything to do with the ability to express ourselves at all, or be willing to go into outside our comfort zone?
I do think that there's probably something about these experiences that can promote a certain kind of flexibility or fluidity or adaptability. Yeah. But I don't know how to capture it in the science.
No. And I think we have to be careful, because it's not about those mood states that create the creativity. But I'm thinking that it's that flexibility that can allow, it's like for me to be able to write about a character that's going into a certain emotional state. I think a lot of actors or anybody, you know, you have that expression, it's like going into the unknown for a while and being willing to sort of be an explorer.
Oh, yeah, no, the exploring thing is fascinating. So we are doing research on, okay, let's say you have one good thing in hand. Will you go out and forage for more and explore just because it's fascinating to see what's out there? Or will you persevere and only stick to, well, I know this one thing? We have a little bit of evidence, and Erin is part of this, that people with bipolar disorder they're more explorers. Even with some safe reward in their hand, they're like, well, what else is out there?
Yeah, and we have a paper that's in the sort of publication process, we hope, right now. So we'll really look forward to sharing the results of that when it's cooked and ready to go. Okay, I think I need a little bit of time to run through a couple of resources at the end. And I'll invite you, Sherry and Victoria, just to dwell on any last sort of closing messages that you'd like to share after that. So I'll come back around to you. But now I'll just walk you through a few of the things that we've shared during today's event. So as previously mentioned, you can access some of the publications on the relationship between creativity and bipolar disorder that have been mentioned today at this website. The CALM program, expertly and beautifully led by Sherry Johnson, is available at this website, calm.berkeley.edu. A lot of our prior work in bipolar disorder over the last decade or so has just been beautifully supported by an organization based in the US that I encourage you to look at, the Sean Costello Memorial Fund for Bipolar Research, which is really an incredible legacy to the legacy of Sean Costello, who lived with a bipolar disorder. Debbie Smith has been a stalwart supporter of all of our program of research in this area. So I really encourage you to check out their work if you haven't heard of them previously. As you probably well know, now all of our Talk BD episodes are available on the podcast platform of your choice. You can access all of the prior episodes through our Talk BD website, including little snippets of moments of the episodes that we were particularly proud of. And here are some of the links for accessing those available to you here. And of course, you can view them on YouTube as well. We're going to start off 2023. Well, first of all, the good news is that we're here for 2023. We have support from our partners and funders to continue these events right the way through next year. We have some incredible topics lined up. We're going to start the new year in a gentle place with a focus on self-compassion and supporting self-compassion practices in bipolar disorder. That's on January 23rd. And we are really very keen to hear from you about future topics that you would like to see us cover. At the end of this webinar, you'll get a short 4-question survey, which will pop up asking you for input into that. You can learn more about CRESBD and our program of research at our academic website, which is where you can also sign up for our newsletters about different research opportunities and publications. Thank you, a huge thank you to all of our supporters who allow us to be here. We've been doing this since the very early days of the pandemic, March 2020. And it's been just been one of the most incredible things to be involved in. And I think that's really down to the participation of the audience and your questions and authenticity that we create in this space together. And a huge thank you to Sherry and Victoria for our time together today. I wonder if you would like to round us out with any closing thoughts.
It's always fun as researchers when we can contribute to something that helps destigmatize. And that's why I think this is in part such an important line of work. But in part, it's an important line of work because the more we understand, the more we can protect. But mostly what I want to do is echo everything Victoria said, that this is a place where growth and recovery and restoration and self-compassion can manifest some of the things that may be built into those genes. But at the same time, if creativity for you means, hey, sometimes I put a really nice bouquet on my dinner table, like, cherish that. Don't feel like you have to be Van Gogh.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I just really would echo the same thing that Sherry said, is that if you don't see yourself as creative or as, art with a capital A, remember what everyday creativity is. And that if you're just being diagnosed and you're feeling like you're stumbling and in the early days, I needed to focus on just learning how to manage my symptoms. My creativity ability to engage in that really came after, because I was still very much trying to ride the waves of the ups and downs. And so if you feel like you've lost touch with your creativity in whatever that creativity is, it's always with you. The only time it goes away is when you die, because being alive is being creative. So don't ever feel like you need to be in a rush to get back to it. It's waiting there. It's happy. It's fine. And so that's the hope that I would want, the message that I want to give. And then slowly you can learn. You'll know. It'll poke its head in, and you'll sort of go, oh yeah, okay, I think I can do that. And then you can try a little bit, and you know, it'll feel a little bumpy, but eventually it'll feel like home again.
I love that analogy, Victoria, the idea of it being like a constant companion that may not always be visible, but is at your side. Beautiful closing notes. Thank you, everybody, for joining us today. Stay safe, stay well, and we will see you in the new year. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye. Bye, Sherry. Bye, Erin. Thanks.
Thank you.